So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking today with PJ Leash. He's in the studio with me. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have him come by to talk about the insects in our lives and a bit today about how you can protect our pollinator population. He also, of course, is going to take your bug-related questions, so I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And PJ Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here today.
How important are pollinators for our Wisconsin crops?
Well, it depends on the crop, but certain crops like cranberries, for example, we grow, we're the top cranberry producer in the country. Bees play a really important role in production of that particular crop. And a lot of the other crops that we think about are fruit crops like apples need pollinators. There are certain crops that maybe aren't entirely pollinator dependent, but if you have pollinators present, the plants do benefit because the fruit, for example, might be larger if you have better pollination that way. And so worldwide, I mean, pollinators are critical for the food supply that we rely on to eat every day.
Yeah, really billions of dollars of value they provide for us.
Definitely, yeah.
Maybe trillions worldwide. You know, last April, the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection released a pollinator protection plan. Talk a bit about that and maybe the circumstances that prompted it.
Sure. So it's hard to listen to the news today and not hear something bad about pollinators. It turns out a lot of pollinators are facing declines, and we don't fully understand why. There's a lot of different interacting factors, be it pesticides, diseases, land use change. We just don't have as much green space around compared to what we used to with urbanization. So pollinators are facing declines for a number of reasons. And because, as we just mentioned, they're really important for agriculture and other reasons. And for that reason, across the country, folks have been coming together to come up with plans to help protect pollinators, minimize risk to pollinators, and help conservation efforts to boost pollinator numbers. And so the state came up with a plan. It really was a cooperative effort. It was a group from the university, Department of Agriculture, industry groups, farmers groups, and they all came to the table and came to that same message of pollinators are important. We need pollinators. We need to do something about them to help them out. And they came up with the plan. Now, the plan itself is about 60 or so pages. It's a long document. But if you track it down, and you can just do a Google search for Wisconsin Pollinator Protection Plan, you'll find it on the Department of Agriculture website, and it's broken down into smaller sections. And so they have a section specific to farms and farmers. They have a section for backyard gardeners and what you can do in your own backyard. There's a lot of really good information in
that
document
cool.
in terms of what you can do to help out pollinators.
And, you know, Jill, maybe we should put that up on our Facebook. We'll put a link up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm looking through the glass at Jill as she's answering calls. She'll put a link up. You know, as pollinators, obviously I think about bees right away, and there's all kinds of bees out there that are pollinators, but there are other insects as well, are there not, that pollinate?
Certainly. If you think about it, any creature that is visiting a plant, a flower, picking up some pollen along the way, and moving it and visiting another flower, they're probably going to do a little bit of pollination. Now, if we look at all of our insects, I mean, bees are perhaps our best pollinators. They have hairs on their body that are almost like Velcro. They're really good for picking up pollen, but there are large numbers of flies, beetles, moths, and butterflies that are pollinators. In some parts of the globe, there are bats that are pollinators.
Yeah.
Small mammals that are pollinators. Recently, scientists figured out that in the ocean, there's actually some pollinators for turtle grasses.
I did not know that.
There's aquatic pollinators, too. So
that's very cool.
Pollinators means more than just bees.
I consider myself a pollinator with Limey, my lime tree, in the house. I go around with my little Q-tip when they're flowering, and I try to move the pollen around from one flower to the next.
There you go.
So I do a little bit, and I'm not the only one. I'm pretty sure of that. the biggest factor, you've talked about it, it's the loss of green space. It could be in pesticides of some sort.
A couple other things come to mind, especially when we think about honeybees, and we hear a lot news about honeybees and winter losses and things like that. Honeybees have a couple of things in particular that stand out. First off, are all the diseases that honeybees can get. There are over 24 different viruses that honeybees can come down ill with. There are bacteria and fungal diseases they can come down ill with. Now, one of the biggest issues that's been identified with honeybees, at least, is a parasitic mite called the varroa mite.
Yeah.
And if you think
it's a bad one.
It's really bad. If you get them in your hive and you don't manage it, it's really only a matter of time before the colony dies out. If you think of these varroa mites, they're almost like a dog tick. It sucks the insect blood or hemolymph out of the bees. That can weaken them. But the same mite can also transmit some of the diseases that bees carry. And so you can have an infested colony, and maybe a worker bee with a mite goes out, visits a flower, the mite falls off, and then it can hop on a bee from a different colony and get spread around that way. So diseases are certainly probably a big factor with honeybee declines, at least.
Well, let's take some calls and move. Well, we can talk some more about pollinators, but we can talk about other kinds of insects as well. So let me give you the number. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you want to post a photo, maybe you've got an insect you'd like to have identified, please go ahead. You can post it on our Facebook page, and the title of the page, The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn to Wanda now in Rice Lake. Wanda, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I don't have a question about pollinators, but I had an odd experience yesterday as I was shoveling snow. I thought I saw a mosquito, and then I sort of discounted it, thinking I must have not seen a mosquito. And then later, near the Christmas tree that I have outside, I saw quite a little cluster of mosquito-like bugs, although it looked like their legs were a little longer and the wings were a little bigger. So tell me, what were they doing, and what might they be?
Sure. Well, my first thought, we have a family of flies that looks very mosquito-like, except they wouldn't have the elongated mouth parts, the proboscis. So they're not blood feeders. They won't bite you. They're from the family Trichoceridae, and they can be fairly common in winter. Actually, and it's a little bit surprising to hear about insects active in winter, but if it's warm enough, generally about 25 degrees, maybe a sunny day or warmer temperatures, there's a number of insects that can be active. I've been out in the woods in the Baraboo Hills certain days and just find swarms of those things. So a family Trichoceridae is my top guess, although when it comes to mosquitoes, there are actually certain types of mosquitoes that will spend the winter as adults, and they will find a sheltered location. It could be a cave or a rock overhang in the woods. They could potentially get into someone's, you know, crawl space, cellar, which might have cave-like conditions. And if you get a warm enough day, it's possible some of those mosquitoes could potentially become active. But I think in this case, probably not mosquitoes, probably those trichocerids I mentioned.
Would those trichocerids, was it relative to being close to that pine tree? Would they have been hatching out of that pine tree, do you think?
No, I wouldn't expect them to come out of the trees. Sometimes, though, you can get these mating swarms, and there may be some visual cues that come into play. And so if you have a Christmas tree lying on the snow, you got this dark-colored object, and you get that contrast. Yeah. Sometimes that can have some interesting roles in insect behavior.
Kind of attract them a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very fun. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Facebook for a minute, because Wendy has posted a cool photo of an insect on the snow. We were just talking about that. What have you got there?
Yeah, so this is a creature I would call a snow fly. It's the genus Chionia. And these are one of these creatures that can be out active in winter. And this particular creature is actually wingless, so they can't fly. But you'll see them just wandering around, kind of stumbling around on the snow surface if it's a warm enough day.
Looks pretty good size, too. It looks kind of like a footprint or an old footprint in the snow. So that one's pretty good size as you look at it compared to someone's heel of a boot.
Yeah, well, usually when I bump into those, they may be about quarter inch long or so. So they're not very big.
Oh, they're not.
It might be a little bit hard to judge from the picture, but they're not terribly large insects.
Very interesting. Sally in Milwaukee called to ask for advice on how to get rid of cockroaches without hurting her pets. Depending on where you live, if you're in an apartment complex, one thing. If you're in a single-family dwelling, another, I would expect.
Definitely, yeah. That's a very good point. Knowing the situation, if it's a single-family home, this is easier. If it's an apartment complex, you'd really have to get apartment management involved because apartments can be tricky with pests. You can have them in one unit. They can very easily move to the neighboring units, up and down stories. And if you only go in and treat in one unit, given time, they'll just move back in. So that's one consideration. Another consideration would be when it comes to cockroaches, we've got a number of different species in the state, and they can have some different preferences and they can indicate different things. Our most common species is the German cockroach, and this is probably the cockroach that gives a lot of the other ones a bad name. They tend to be not all that big, maybe half inch long, give or take. They need fresh water. They need a water source to live. And so if you've got leaking pipes, pet water bowls, condensation on a toilet or something like that, they need that. If you can fix or correct those water issues, that's an important step with that particular species. But perhaps one of the biggest things is food. If you have spilled food around, it could be crumbs kicked under a stove, behind a refrigerator. If that food is around, they've got a food source to live off of. So sanitation, cleaning things up, keeping it really neat and tidy can be important. There are also some baits out there, which have gotten really good over the last couple of decades. What's nice about baits is we can apply them in spots where pets and kids just aren't going to get to them. We can apply them nooks and crannies under the kitchen sink, behind the stove, places like that.
Yeah, where they like to be anyway, the cockroaches.
Exactly. So you have to think a little bit like a cockroach. Go where they are going to be hanging out. We can put baits there. There's insecticide sprays that can be used in some cases, but one of the biggest things is cleaning things up. If you put out baits, but they still have food around that they can feed on, you're not going to get good results. You got to clean things up. You can try some of the baits. If it's really a challenge, you always have the option to call in a pest control company, get the pros in there and deal with the situation. They can certainly help out, too.
You can join in again, 1-800-642-1234. Talking today with P.J. Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects with P.J. Leash, I'm Larry Mueller, and we'll turn to Mary in Madison next for a question. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, this concerns the commercial European honeybee and its traveling.
Yeah.
Seasonal traveling for blueberries and, you know, peaches or whatever. Is there a study that has bees not traveling all over? You know, they stay in one place, and does that kind of help them or not?
Yeah. So is shipping them around or moving them around, is that harmful to the bees?
Yeah, so good question. I'm not aware of any specific studies that I've come across. There certainly could be something out there. My general thoughts, though, if you think about bees, and especially in commercial beekeeping situations, the beekeepers may have, you know, hundreds or thousands of hives that they could ship from a place like Wisconsin or another state. And those bees can get shipped to places like California to pollinate in the almond groves. They could then go up to the Dakotas for sunflowers or elsewhere across the country. Now, we had mentioned a few moments ago about the diseases that bees can get and also the parasitic mites. And so if you have disease situations, and you know, you could think about this from a human health standpoint too, if there are a disease outbreak and you take a bunch of bees or a bunch of people and put them together, there's an increased chance perhaps that disease transmission could occur. So there could be some, certainly some implications of some of these beekeeping practices that may spread diseases or parasites. Many of the commercial beekeepers, though, have some tricks up their sleeve for splitting hives to increase hive numbers, and they can kind of compensate for some of these losses. But definitely that is one thing that has been looked at as a possibility in this overall bee decline. Some of these beekeeping practices, does that not necessarily kill bees outright, but just lead to some general stress during transport?
Makes good sense. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil in Slinger has something for us. Hi, Neil.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a silly thing about snow fleas. And a lot of people don't believe it until you tell them about them. And you can usually brush the bark of a wild black cherry or something, and these little specks, if you take a pocket magnifier, you see that they're actual little insects. And I don't know their proper name. We've always called them snow fleas, but I've had to bring them into town in a jar with snow sometimes to show folks that they are there and alive.
Very cool. And they are indeed, PJ.
Yeah, so there's a creature out there called snow fleas, and they are technically from a group we'd call the springtails or the calembola. And there's actually a bunch of different species of springtails out there. They can be common in areas that have kind of damp soil, rotting plant material, those sorts of things. A lot of these creatures, the springtails, feed on things like fungal spores. But we do have this dark-colored species, which we call snow fleas, and that's where we often bump into them, is on the snow, and they are teeny tiny. It really looks like someone took a pepper shaker and just sprinkled it out on the snow surface. And if it's a warm enough winter day and you take a close peek, you'll see the little black specks jumping around. And that's one of the reasons they're called springtails.
Very cool. Thanks, Neil. Appreciate the call. I just looked on Facebook again, and we've got a very cool photo here of some orange and black insects in the wintertime, or is it in the winter? I'm not sure when that was taken. Anyway, the person's wondering what they are.
You know, I can tell it's not winter because that
I see the
milkweed pod there is green.
Yeah.
But that's an important clue. These are what some folks call milkweed seed bugs, and they look a little bit like box elder bugs, black and kind of orangish, although these tend to be larger than box elder bugs, and they feed on seed pods of milkweed plants. Now, from my experience and observation, they don't seem to cause that much damage to the plants, but it's not uncommon for folks to bump into these, especially late in summer, July, August, September. They can move on to neighboring plants in the flower bed. So just one of these creatures that can be fairly common that time of the year.
Yeah, pretty cool. As you're listening to the show, I hope you'll go to my Facebook page and our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at that under visitor posts, because you may have had some of those on your milkweed plants. Kelly in Williams Bay, on to you now. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I am calling. We recently purchased a home that's an older home, and with that home, we inherited a large amount of box elder bugs and Japanese beetles. And with this thaw, the box elder bugs are already moving. I'm finding them in my children's room and in the bathroom. We have a front porch that they also love to be with the Japanese beetles. And I'm just wondering, besides using a vacuum, which I have done to suck them up, and then I take them outside, what can I do to get rid of these box elder bugs and Japanese beetles that we have inherited with this home we purchased?
Okay. So when you say Japanese beetle, is this a creature you're finding in the house?
Yeah, they're ladybugs.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Sure, sure.
Which exact is a Japanese beetle or a ladybug, but they look like ladybugs.
Okay, sure. In that case, we are talking about a species of ladybug called the multicolored Asian lady beetle.
Okay.
And both those lady beetles and box elder bugs have a very similar story.
Okay.
They overwinter in sheltered locations. Now, out in nature, they would crawl beneath the bark of a rotting tree, a hollow log, a rock pile, something like that. But if there are buildings available, they will sneak indoors, gaps in siding and in other areas like that, a crack in a foundation or something along those lines. Now, unfortunately, once those insects have gotten in, if they are hanging out in a wall void or a soffit area, and it's warm enough, maybe 45, 50 degrees, they become active. They wander around the home. Indoors, they're really, for the most part, pretty harmless. They're not going to hurt people at all. But they're a nuisance. Now, unfortunately, once they've gotten in, we've basically lost the battle.
You're done for this year.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
You haven't lost the war. I mean, the ultimate solution is because these things sneak in from outside, you got to look at the outside of your house, figure out where they're getting in. Cracks and crevices, if we can fill those up with caulk, expanding insulation foam, anything else to kind of tighten things up, that prevents them from getting in. Once they're indoors, we can vacuum, we can sweep, we can catch them in Tupperware and throw them back outside. But unfortunately, we don't have too many options. It doesn't make sense to spray an insecticide indoors for these because they're just not going to hurt anything. They're not going to live very long.
Right.
So unfortunately, the vacuum is probably about the best you could do.
And they tend to go in when in September, warm days of September, August?
Yeah.
It's September, really, isn't it?
Yeah, basically early fall. Late September, and for the Asian lady beetles, I think mostly of October, they actually have an environmental cue, kind of those last really warm days that we call Indian summer, where it might get up to 65 in second, third week of October. When they have those warm temperatures and the temperature drops, that's a cue for them to look for overwintering spots. And so outdoors, if you tighten things up, that helps. If you just can't do that with the type of home, you can spray or have a pest control company spray the exterior of your home with an insecticide. The thought is that we kill or repel those insects before they get indoors, and you would do that sometime in September.
Yeah, and typically on the sunny side of the house, you wouldn't have to do the whole house necessarily, would you?
Right. Yeah, these insects, they tend to like the southern side and the western side because that's where you get the warmer afternoon sun.
That's correct. One last quick question. We're close to a sanctuary, a conservancy, and we're up against woods, acres of woods.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm experiencing ticks for the first time this past spring, and I know it's going to be coming again. Is it worth spraying, having the yard sprayed to prevent ticks, like as an outer boundary to the couple acres that we have?
Yeah, so that is a consideration that some folks will do. Now, if you think about tick management, it can depend on kind of the landscape structure of your yard. If you've got a turf grass lawn, those areas tend to be too open, too sunny, too dry, and ticks don't seem to like those areas. Where we find a lot of ticks is that interface or the change from a wooded area to the lawn. And so that is something that folks can do is basically treat a band of 5 to 10 feet right along the edge of your lawn where it bumps up to woods or a sanctuary. The thought is that if we do that in spring, that may kill off and cut down on the number of ticks that are potentially moving from that wooded area into your backyard. So that's something you could consider.
Okay, great. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly, for calling. And let's go to John next in New Berlin. Hi, John.
Hi, I'm getting chigger bites, at least that's what my doctor tells me they are, and I'm on my third tube of permethrin. I mean, where did I get these things? How do I got to get rid of them?
Where are you being bit?
All over the place, from like the chest down. They leave marks, too.
And is that happening this time of the year?
I transplanted a lot of little maple trees last year, so I think it was from the dirt, or at least that's what he says. And I've never had this happen before either.
And you're still getting bitten?
Well, yeah.
Okay, so
do I have to burn everything I own or what?
No. I mean, when it comes to chiggers, overall, they're pretty rare in the state. I don't get that many verified reports. Now, when folks do bump into chiggers, it's if you're outside doing lots of yard work, and they're kind of like ticks in that you probably aren't going to bump into them in a backyard turf grass area. It's too hot, too open, too sunny and dry. If you're out in the woods or a grassy area, that's where you're more likely to bump into chiggers, although, as I said, they're still not that common in the state. But to have bites that continue, I really wonder if there's something else going on.
Cause,
well, I live alone and I sleep alone, if that helps.
Okay, well, you know.
No cats or dogs?
No pets.
Okay.
Or pets.
I mean, when folks are getting bites or skin irritation this time of the year, one of the things I have to think about is something like bed bugs, at least, if that's something we need to cross off the list. But that's always a possibility because chiggers...
You can see bed bugs, right?
Well, in general, you can if they're right in front of you, but they tend to be pretty good at hiding. They spend... Yeah. 95%+ of their time in hiding in cracks and crevices behind beds and mattresses and things like that. So you generally won't see them out in the open unless there's a really bad infestation.
Right.
But if you do an internet search for bed bug inspection, University of Minnesota has a really good protocol for that on their Let's Beat the Bed Bug website. Poke around and look for that at least to rule it out. But otherwise, this time of the year, there aren't that many biting creatures that are going to be around.
Well, this has been since last summer.
Yeah, so that pattern just doesn't fit with chiggers to have that continued irritation. Typically, when folks bump into chiggers, they encounter them outdoors. They get reddish rash skin irritation for a few days, and then things clear up. So to have this persistent irritation just doesn't fit the profile for chiggers.
Yeah, I'd check that website out on bed bugs for sure. Good luck. Thank you very much, and John, let us know what you find out. You're likely to find some things out. Doug in Green Bay up next. Doug, hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I was listening to your show, and the lady called in about the Asian beetles, which is something I dealt with for many years in my residence, and tried everything until one day the vacuum cleaner was sitting out with the hose hooked up to it, and I just went around and I vacuumed all these critters up. And then they were gone for a period of time, and then every once in a while one would show up, and I had that vacuum cleaner handy, and I kept vacuuming them all up, and that went on for maybe a month or two. And they're gone. I haven't had them for a couple of years now.
Yeah?
So yeah. I just thought I'd share that with you. I don't know if it really works, but it worked for me.
Well, it's a good way, quick way to get rid of them, isn't it, BJ?
Yeah, I mean, a vacuum cleaner certainly works. As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, collecting them by hand or in a Tupperware, that works as well. Persistence can pay off. Also, the numbers and populations of Asian lady beetles can fluctuate from year to year. So you could have a bad year, and then a couple years down the road, you just don't see many of them, too. So it's possible there's that sort of dynamic. Interestingly, in 2014 and 2015, the Asian lady beetles were bad. I mean, pretty bad in a lot of parts in the state. For whatever reason, in 2016, their number seemed to be a little bit lower. I didn't have quite as many calls. So as I said, their numbers can fluctuate year to year.
Katie in Madison has something for us. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I kind of wanted to circle back to bees. And I've been reading a lot about in the news about discrepancies and results regarding pollinator health between industry-funded research and third-party non-industry-funded research. And so I'm wondering, how are the results of either of these channels sort of affecting pesticide practice and application in the state?
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Are you seeing those kinds of differences as well, BJ?
Well, I mean, when it comes to pesticide research, there's a lot that goes on out there between all of the agricultural crops and landscape plants out there. We do know from some of these studies that certain insecticides can be highly toxic to bees. There's a certain group called the neonicotinoids that we know if bees come into exposure with a lot of those chemicals, it's lights out for the bees. And so some of that information has definitely been taken into consideration developing these pollinator protection plans. There's been a lot of documents that have come out across the country in terms of best management practices for what to do. And a lot of the important points are along the lines of either not using some of those products that are highly toxic to bees, using alternatives that are less or essentially non-toxic to bees, or doing some cultural practices or other things to minimize or eliminate exposure to bees, spraying at times a day that the bees aren't active, eliminating drift and those sort of things. So from the research that's out there, we do get some clues about what's really affecting the bees.
We have Pam on Facebook wondering if pet owners should be concerned about ticks because of the warming weather that's coming up across the state.
Yeah, so overall, I mean, if you're in the far north where you still have pretty good snow cover, it shouldn't be much of a concern. Down here in the southern part of the state, I do start to wonder about that a little bit. Ticks are, because they're cold-blooded, the warmer it is, the more active they tend to be. But we can have some tick activity when it's still pretty cold out. As long as it's above freezing and there's no snow cover on the ground, you could potentially bump into ticks. I know in the Madison area, there's a few spots. My wife and I, with our two dogs, have bumped into ticks even in February.
Okay.
When there's been a warm spell and there's been no snow cover on the ground. So it's something to keep
keep your eyes out. Here, let's go back to Facebook for a minute because we've got several photos. Here's one from Tanya, wondering if this is a mosquito, something she took in December of 2016.
Yeah, so from what I can see in this picture, it does have the elongated proboscis or mouth part, so it does appear to be a mosquito. I mentioned earlier in the show today that there are certain mosquitoes that will spend the winter as adults in cold locations. On occasion, they even get down into someone's basement where it's just cool enough that they kind of go dormant. And so it's certainly possible that one of those winter adult species happened to become active and you found one.
And then something here from Cynthia. I was just chopping some ice and came across these critters. About a third of them were moving and the others are just kind of floating around. What might they be? They're in an area where there's solid mole population.
Yeah, so these are the snow fleas that we talked about a couple minutes ago. Again, they're teeny tiny little dark-colored creatures, but if you sit there and watch them, springtails basically have, think of it as a miniature pogo stick built into their anatomy until you see them bouncing around an inch or two at a time.
And then another photo from Jackie, and I'm trying to, it looks like an expired bug of some sort.
Yeah, looks like a beetle of some kind with the shape of the tarsi, or basically the foot of the insect, and the coloration. I wonder if it may be a type of soldier beetle, although I just can't quite tell for sure from the picture. If they still have the physical specimen, they'd always be welcome to send it into my lab, and I can take a closer peek.
All right. And let's turn to Diane in Keel, who called to say that she uses cedar mulch every year around her house. And she says it's really helped keep box elder and Asian lady beetles out of her house.
Well, when it comes to things like different mulches, I mean, if you get cedar mulch, it certainly has this very pleasant smell to it. There's some thoughts that maybe that repels insects, keeps them at bay. When it comes to these types of scents, if you look into the research, any type of repellency really tends to be fairly short-lived from essential oils and strong-smelling things. And so I would suspect in this case, you might have just gotten lucky. You put the mulch down and you just got lucky for a couple of years there. But I wouldn't really expect much of a strong repellent effect from those type of things.
And we were talking about springtails earlier, and Aaron in Milwaukee wondered what's the best way to get rid of springtails.
Well, so if springtails are outdoors, there's not really much we can do about them just because their life cycle is linked in with weather. If it's damp, well, we tend to have more springtails. 2016, I had a lot of springtail cases because we had a lot of rain in the state. If springtails are indoors, that can indicate potentially a couple of different things. If they are found in a location like the basement, tells me it's a little bit damp. If you were to run a dehumidifier, get the humidity down, that should certainly help take care of the issue. Because if the humidity gets too low, they just can't survive.
They can't live.
Yeah. If you are encountering springtails upstairs in the main portion of your home, a couple things could be going on. Occasionally, springtails will sneak in from outdoors. You can get snow fleas accumulating on the side of a house or other springtails. That would be a matter of just improving the weather stripping and tightening things up, kind of like the box elder bugs. If you're finding them in a part of your home where you have house plants, that could be another source. If you have house plants with very damp soil, you get decomposing leaves and things like that. Springtails can live in those situations too. So in terms of the context, there could be a couple different things going on depending on where you're finding them in the home.
talking today with P.J. Leash, who directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. We've got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Give us a call with your insect question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Now taking a look at in the world of insects with P.J. Leash. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. Let's turn back to the phones now. And Chris in Harvard, Illinois. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hopefully we can get this solved without a pitcher. But what this bug is it comes out usually in the wintertime, along with the box elder bugs. But this is a beetle. It has very long legs, two large, antennas that are very tall. And it goes very slowly across the carpet or across the wall. And if the dog comes up to it, you can tell it has an odor. So I don't want to call it necessarily a stink bug or something like that. But it also seems to function. If a cat plays with it, a leg will fall off, let's say. And the thing is still able to function and to move along, no matter if it loses one leg or four legs, it's still, able to move. But the antennas, are always going very slow. It's kind of like a taupe or a brown color. It doesn't have a beetle-type shell, super hard, but it does have, it's kind of a little more firm than, let's say, a wasp or something like that.
Okay.
The general shape of the body, is it kind of like a shield, like from a medieval knight, or is it more of a narrow body?
Like a military type of looking.
Okay.
And it almost goes to a point at the rear.
Okay. Fairly slender insect?
Yes.
Okay.
And the legs are very, almost like praying mantis-like.
Okay. Do you happen to have the insect in front of you?
I do not.
Okay. My first thought, if it is more of a slender insect, we have a creature called the Western conifer seed bug. And one of the defining features of that insect, and it would look somewhat beetle-like, it's kind of darkish, reddish-brown color. Right in the middle of the back, there's these two whitish zigzag lines. It looks like a little lightning bolt symbol.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. If that's the case, this would be your culprit, Western conifer seed bug. They are associated with, they feed on the pine cones and seed cones of other conifers. Don't really harm the trees all that much, but they're kind of like box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles. They like to sneak indoors in the fall.
Yeah, and so, it just amazes me that they can lose a leg and they're still going, and another leg, and there's, the dogs won't, smell them, mm-hmm. and, maybe put their paw on them, but they just keep going. I mean, they just keep, no matter what they lose, they're still
going. Sure. Well, from an entomologist's point of view, I've collected a number of these over the years, and when I go to pin them, they tend to be notoriously brittle. And I'd say probably half of my specimens have at least lost one, if not more, legs. So the legs tend to fall off on these things. Because they feed on conifers, they pick up some of those scent compounds, and they do have these scent glands that can have a defensive function. They're harmless indoors, but they're probably going to wander around. So sweep them up, get the hose attachment of the vacuum cleaner, and deal with them that way.
Well, thank you very much, because the dogs, cats are definitely intrigued, but they do smell when they squish them. So thank you so much for your help. We love your program.
Thank you very much for calling, Chris. Well, let's go to Laura next in Madison. Laura, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling because I have a weird, really long-looking ant with long gray, wings. And it comes out in my apartment usually just one I see maybe a week or so. So there's not a lot of them, but they come out pretty constantly in the summer and in the winter. And it's interesting because when I see one, it'll kind of fly around as if it was a little dazed, and then it'll die off. So I don't even have to kill it. I just have to wait for it to die in my apartment. I'm wondering, what are these? I'm from Arizona. I'm not from Wisconsin, so I don't know what type of ant this is. It's a flying ant. And also, where could I find a nest, or how do I find out where they're coming from? Because I'm not too sure how to even handle them, since there's only once every week or so.
Sure. Well, when it comes to ants in Wisconsin, we probably have about a dozen or so species that can be encountered indoors fairly commonly. So without seeing the specimen, it's going to be basically impossible for me to tell you the exact species. So one thing that could be helpful, the next time you find some of these ants, collect them, send them into my lab at UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I can identify them under the microscope for you. Once we know what the exact species is, that will tell us more information about what the implications are, because certain ants, like carpenter ants, could potentially indicate water damage, for example. But we do get some other ants, like citronella ants, that we can get winged forms, and it's basically a nuisance, but they're not going to hurt anything. They'll actually live in the soil below the foundation of the home. So we'd have to identify the exact ant species. Once we know that, we'll know the implications. We'll also know what would be best to do for management. So I would definitely collect a few, send them in to me, and we can go from there.
There we go.
Thank you.
Keep your eyes peeled, Laura. Collect a few and send them in. Louise in Oconomowoc, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I really appreciate your show. I don't go anywhere until I hear it in the morning.
Thanks.
At any rate, I'm calling. I have an African gray parrot and a cat, and I live in an apartment complex, and I've lived here for 7 years. And in the very beginning when I moved here, there was this similar, we thought it was like a carpet beetle, but it was fuzzy and it has a black line across it. We looked it on the computer, and it looked really similar to a bug called the leader bug. And I was told by an 86-year-old woman who told me, if you want to get rid of everything, she said, use 20-methylene borax and put it everywhere around your apartment, the crack, you know, all around, everywhere on the outside where anything could get in. And I've used that, and I have never seen another one again. And I wouldn't let them come in to spray because I'm very fearful. My African gray parrot, you know, you can't even use soft silverstone pots or pans. I had to throw those all away. At any rate, I wanted to tell people that and find out from you if that is a what does it do? Is it the acid that burns their feet and they lick themselves and die?
Well, so borax in general has been used for a very long time. It can work as essentially a stomach poison if insects are to ingest it. And so there are certain products out there that you can buy a borax powder and use it in some cases. There are other insect control products where that borax has been incorporated into a bait for ants, for example. So borax has kind of this long history of usage for dealing with insects. When it comes to kind of insect-proofing your house, there are some other products I would maybe think of using before borax. There are other types of powders like diatomaceous earth and specially formulated powdered silica gel that can be basically puffed into wall voids and cracks and crevices, and it can insect-proof those areas for long periods of time. But in general, there is definitely some truth behind the borax, and it has been used for a very long time for aspects of insect pest control.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Louise. And Joanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I like your program. I learned so much. I just learned something about borax.
There you go.
In any case, when I'm gardening in my vegetable garden and working in the soil and I come across beetle grubs, I'm always wondering if there's some way I could tell the difference between a June beetle grub or a beetle grub from a beetle that is helpful in the garden.
Sure. So the short answer is yes, there are ways to tell them apart. Unfortunately, they're not going to be very easy to do unless you have some magnification. So the white grubs have this C-shaped body. You got the head at one end. At the back end, basically the butt end of the insect, we have a region called the raster. And there is a series of hairs and spines on that part of the body. And that's one of the important clues we can use for identifying beetle white grubs. On something like a May-June beetle, it's going to look like a zipper. There's these two parallel lines of spines, and you can find pictures online of that pretty easily. You'd need probably 10x magnification or a good magnifying glass to actually see that. Otherwise, you often have to get them under the microscope. The problem is there's so many different scarab beetles and white grubs out there that there's really a steep learning curve to identify all those. But the two that can be fairly easily identified, the May-June beetles, they got that zipper, two-pair line pattern. Japanese beetles have a little V-shaped pattern on there. Some of the other harmless white grubs that are associated with decomposing plant matter and things like that, they're not going to have those patterns present.
All right.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for calling. And Steve in Dubuque, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Steve.
My mom has a problem with they call them stink bugs. They're almost like a little beetle, like a, you know, and they fly. They're similar to the one the lady was just talking about a little bit ago that crawls across the carpet. You know, it's got a hard shell, and if you smash it, it leaves off an odor. But these take flight. You know what I mean? They fly around, and they might get on the blinds or something, or take off. You know, they go by the window. I don't know where they're coming from. You know, they pop up, you know, three or four times a week here and there, a couple at a time, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's similar to what the lady was talking about that crawled across the carpet, you know, and had like a shield on the back. It's real sleek, slender.
Okay.
You know? So I
okay.
Just,
yeah.
Well, a couple thoughts. It may be that same creature we spoke about a few minutes ago, that Western conifer seed bug, which has kind of a fairly slender body, about 3/4 of an inch long, reddish brown in color. Another possibility, there is a creature called a brown marmorated stink bug, which has a shield shaped body, a little bit shorter body, about 1/2 inch. That one tends to have more beige color in the body. Both of those creatures can sneak indoors in the fall. Both can give off a pretty small, strong smell if disturbed, and those brown marmorated stink bugs can fly indoors. I've seen that myself, so that could
that
be.
That is a one.
That's
now, what
one.
Would they? Now, would they be on? Like, she's got some Christmas decorations. What would they? What attracts them, or what would keep them? Where would I find them in the house? How would I get rid of them?
Well, the tricky part now is that if you have them indoors, I mean, they're not going to feed on anything, but to find more of them, find the source, they're probably hidden in places like wall voids and things like that where we just can't
get. You're not going to get in there.
Yeah.
So vacuum them up when they...
Yeah.
No, I don't have a problem. She just gets all excited. She's elderly.
Yeah.
One quick question on fleas. Do they fleas outdoors? Do they, on my dog, will they come around in the winter much? I mean, how warm and how cold do they disappear?
Well, so fleas, like a lot of other insects, they really need it to be about 50 or so degrees for them to really become pretty active. And another thing is this time of the year, I don't see many flea cases because, A, it's cold outside, B, the humidity is pretty low this time of the year, which is also harsh on fleas. Not that you can't bump into fleas indoors with pets, dogs, cats, that sort of thing. But in terms of folks picking up fleas on their pets outdoors this time of the year, it's not the season that I would think of.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Because I'm not too far. I'm in Dubuque, Iowa, so I'm only 25 minutes from you in Platteville.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yep. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to warmer climates, Mexico, and talk with Robert. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling about termites. You may not have any expertise of Mexican termites, but they're eating my house 400 miles south of Tucson, Arizona, into Mexico. And I wonder if there might be something I can spread around. You were talking about borax here earlier.
I don't know that borax is going to do it, PJ.
Yeah, so termites can be a little bit tricky. Now, in Wisconsin, we've got a fairly simple termite situation because we really only have one species that folks would bump into. And up here, it's really restricted to isolated pockets in the state where they had probably been brought in with infested wood materials. Now, you go to warmer climates down into Mexico and places like that, there's a lot of other termite species that could potentially be at play. So the most important step would be to figure out exactly which species you're dealing with, because that would have some implications on the management. Now, typically in warmer climates, when folks have termite issues, they usually have to work with a pest control company because termites can be very tricky to deal with. You need some tools and techniques and other equipment to really deal with them adequately.
Yeah, you almost have to tent the house, don't you? Or...
Well, in some cases, they can use fumigation. Depending on the termite species, they can drill holes into wood beams and inject products in there. For certain termite species, there are some bait stations available, but it all depends on the exact termite species that you'd be dealing with.
Yeah, and in Mexico, if he sent some to you, would you be able to identify or not?
My general policy, I don't
try
accept,
to stay with Wisconsin.
Yeah, there are some issues.
Or at least Midwest.
Yeah, well, I can take pictures, although with termites, you really need to get some specimens under the microscope, and you need the winged forms. From the workers, you often can't tell. But I'm really restricted to taking physical specimens from within the state. When it comes to a place like Mexico, I would perhaps do some Google searching, see if there is a nearby university, especially with an entomology department, and try and link up with them.
All right. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll be back. You stay with us. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest, P.J. Leash. I'm Larry Mueller, and P.J. manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him along. And if you have a question, maybe you've noticed some unusual bugs in your house or yard, maybe you have a question about them, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you have a photo you want to post that up on our Facebook page if there's an identification question. That's a good place to put it, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Otherwise, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we have open lines, so we'll get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Bev on Facebook wants to know how to get rid of grease ants. They come from the base of the kitchen window, she says. She says regular ant killers don't work.
Sure. So when it comes to ants, each ant species has a slightly different taste preference in the types of foods that they like. Some ants really love sweets and sugar-rich foods. Other ants, like thief or grease ants, like foods that have a high protein or fat content. And so if you go to the hardware store and pick up some sugar-based ant bait, and that can be the pretty common stuff, It's sugars, and so the ants just don't want to have anything to do with it.
Okay.
So you could try a different ant bait that says on the container for protein-based ants. That should, I'd expect it to work. Or you could try the sugar-based bait, especially if you have a liquid formulation. Cut out a little piece of wax paper and put some of that bait on there and then mix it into a little bit of peanut butter cooking oil, a food that has protein fat, and see if the ants will then go to it and accept that bait. If they do, then it's just a matter of time of getting them enough bait. And if they eat it all and take it back to the nest, put out more bait for them, and that should clear things up over time.
Laurel in Eagle River has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Laurel.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a problem that I think actually came from one time when I bought some homemade doggy biscuits, and these little bugs came out of it. And from I've heard other things that I think they lay their eggs or something in my houseplant dirt because it's nice and warm and wet. But they fly around, they go, and they get into such things as if cereals, grains of any sort, you know, box stuff, even to the point that if I bought a box of, let's say,
Bisquick?
Of a cereal, like an oatmeal or whatever, they'll even eat into the box. So I have seen reports on it, but I've never had a chance to record what kind of chemical can I use to put on my plants. One time I had read about the stuff that you get that's supposed to, you put on plants, you get it in the gardening section or something that I could inside put on the soil to get rid of these critters.
Sure.
Not necessarily that they're in the plants, though, are they, PJ?
No, I wouldn't think so. So when it comes to our pantry insects, there is a number of caterpillars that turn into moths. There are quite a few beetles out there that will infest cereal and Bisquick and things like that. But those insects really wouldn't have an interest in the houseplants. So if you do have insects...
They hang around there. They'll even get where I have lights, you know, because I have lights for my houseplants, and they'll get up in the lights.
Okay.
And they're very small.
Well, so we do have something else called fungus gnats that can be kind of notorious. They tend to be small, kind of dark-colored flies that hang out near houseplants. Those insects really don't have any interest in the food in your pantry.
John, so probably dealing with two different kinds of things, maybe.
Yeah,
well,
I...
on the hard side. And I can get them up on fly paper. I can catch them on this.
Okay. I mean, there's a few other things associated with houseplants, but in general, the types of insects that like houseplants aren't going to go to the food in your pantry. So I'm really suspicious. We're dealing with two different things here. What you could do, if you collect some, send them in to me or send me some good images. That may help us figure out what they are. But as I said, I think we're dealing with two different things. When it comes to the insects in food in your pantry, if you find or you know you got a bad box with bugs in it, throw that one out or throw it in the freezer to kill them off. Otherwise, if you take food when you get it and put it into some containers that seal really well, Tupperware with a good lid, that sort of thing.
But these things are so little. That's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was, you know, first I one time had saw these in these doggy biscuits. So I don't know if they came from the doggy biscuits or if they got into the doggy biscuits from some other
place. Yeah.
Well, we can't really tell. I mean, either of those could be possibilities. And dog food and dog treats are often a potential food source that folks often overlook in the kitchen because they're worried about people food. Well, insects can go after the dog biscuits too. So it's possible something came in or they had been around in low numbers and just happened to hit the jackpot when they bumped into the dog treats.
So if you can get some good photos or even better yet, if you can mail some in to...
Yeah, I think in this case, if the insects are small, I'd probably have to see them under the microscope.
Ah, okay. And the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, we have a link on our Facebook page, but what's the address?
Mailing address is 1630 Linden Drive, L-I-N-D-E-N. It's room number 240, and that is Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. So again, 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706.
All right. There we go. And good luck, Laurel. Thank you. And I hope you'll put some in and maybe a couple of different kinds. There you might need to find a couple different kinds. Angela in Birchwood has something for us. Hi, Angela.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have two different questions. The first one pertains to snow fleas. And where we are, I was walking not long ago and it was, you know, 0 degrees, 5 degrees above. And there are these insects that are just, you know, happily flying around right above the level of the snow. So I'm assuming it must have some sort of internal antifreeze properties, but I'm not sure what that would be. So that was my first question. And my second question actually pertains to bumblebees, and we live in a very wooded area, and I'm thinking about putting up hives this year and wondering if there's an optimal number or distances apart. You know, do they prefer different plants in different parts of the state? You know, do certain bees tend to go to one particular area, and so they develop a taste for certain things? So, and that's sort of new to me, so I'm contemplating that as well.
Mm-hmm. Kind of in the northeast part of the state?
Northwest.
Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I guess the first part of your question, Angela, the snow fleas and other creatures in winter, you're exactly right. A lot of those creatures basically are able to produce their own antifreeze chemicals in their body, which prevents them from freezing solid and being killed by that. And that allows them to be active at surprisingly low temperatures.
So, it was astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, when it comes to bees and along the general lines of what can we do in our own backyards to help out bees? Well, a couple thoughts here. The first would be to put out and plant a very, very wide variety of native plants. And I really like to go native. If you start looking at some of the very flashy, newer horticulture varieties, those plants might have been bred to be very visually appealing to humans, but those same flowers might have extra petals, but very little pollen and nectar. And so if we want to help out our native bees, probably the best thing you can do is put out lots of native plants. Now, also when it comes to bees, we've got about 400 or so species in the state. Some can be active very early in the spring, basically once that snow melts off and they have overwintered and they'll become active. There can be some active into the fall. And so we don't just want a diversity of flowers. We want a diversity of flowers blooming throughout the entire year if possible, or the entire growing season, to help out as many bees as possible. So lots of different types of native plants. For certain bees, we can put out nesting habitats, bee houses, bee hotels, that sort of thing, because those bees will nest in hollow tubes. I know for things like mason bees, you can order kits online. Other things you can do in the yard is simply avoiding using pesticides, or use them only if you really need to. Mm-hmm. And so all those things can be done to help out bees and other pollinators in our backyard.
Is there a number? Are there a number of hives that are the optimal number, or does it really matter? You know, are they territorial, like too many hives, we're not going to stay here sort of thing, or not?
Sure. And you're talking about honeybees?
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, there are beekeepers that will have bee yards full of dozens, if not hundreds, of beehives,
yeah.
And they seem to do fine. So I really don't think there's an optimal number of hives you need to be concerned about. I would, you know, the number of hives should probably be based mostly on your interest and how involved you want to be and how much time you have.
Okay, and how interested the bears are. Okay.
All right, there we go. Thanks, Angela.
Thank you.
Jim and Lucita, let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing there?
Great, appreciate the call.
Yeah, I'm in Lucita here. I've got a little debate that's been going on for the last couple of years between my son and a good friend of mine in Upper Michigan. We this is referring to that western conifer seed bug.
Yeah.
That's what we have seen, and I was hoping your other caller would have brought it up, but he didn't. How do you tell the difference between this western conifer seed bug and an assassin bug? They seem to be very similar in everything I've looked at so far.
Sure. So to tell them apart in really good detail, you'd have to get them under a microscope. There's actually an entire family of assassin bugs, the family Reguviidae. It's a diverse group. We have a fair number of common species in the state indoors. We've got a masked hunter bug that folks bump into on occasion. But you're definitely right, Jim. They can have a fairly similar looking body, that slender, elongate body. Some species can be about the same size as western conifer seed bug. The easiest way to tell them apart, if you look at the western conifer seed bug, it's from a family we call the leaf-footed bugs. And if you look at the hind legs, they look like they're wearing bell-bottom pants from the 1970s. Their leg is very, very much widened and flared out, hence the name of leaf-footed bugs. Also, right in the middle of their back, they've got these white little lightning bolt or zigzag patterns, or it looks like an upside-down number 4. If you see those, you know you got the western conifer seed bug. If you don't see those, it could be an assassin bug, but there's some other possibilities as well.
Okay, because there's so many different pictures out there, and to differentiate between them, it's just been so difficult, you know. And I got a friend of mine; he is just scared to hell that he doesn't want nothing to do with the assassin bug. And neither do I personally. So.
Yeah, sure. There you go.
When it comes to assassin bugs, the species we have around here really aren't a concern for people. They don't spread any diseases, the ones we have here. They're really probably not going to bite you unless you picked them up and mishandled them. One thing I will mention is if you were to go to my website, I've got some visual identification guides, and some of those have the western conifer seed bug on the guides, and it will point to the important features to look for. So check that out. To look for the key features.
And what's your site again?
If you just did an internet search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you should be able to find it.
Okay, sounds real good. Thanks, appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. And you can join in too, 800-642-1234. Get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Sylvia in Appleton next. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I would like to promote bee houses, if you want to call them that. I purchased one several years ago at a rummage sale. It has holes, different sizes on both sides, and the bees are using it, the solitary bees. Mm-hmm. They were using one little strip on the back side. I had it against the garage where they could get in between the two different boards. There was an opening.
Yep.
Well, the woodpeckers are getting the ones on the outside. But I turned it over a couple months ago, and the backside, after we put little extensions on it, about a quarter of an inch to keep it away from the wood, is almost full. It doesn't keep those little tiny parasitic wasps out of there, but for the number of solitary bees that are using it, I was astounded. And they are slightly different sized holes, and they were almost all filled. And my question is for PJ, where are the spiders? I have been finding very few spiders the last couple of years.
Hmm.
I'm an acquaintance of Jack Casper's, so I kind of like the spiders.
Yeah. Inside the house or outside, or
outside.
Both?
Both. Actually, I have a few focus in the house, but I used to see cherocanthiums. You'd go and turn the light on at night. There'd be four or five of them on the top of the ceiling in the kitchen. No problem. If I find them during the summer, they go outside. Otherwise, they go down the basement. But agiapes, I haven't seen any for 2 years, and I look for them. I have very few aranias around here. And the same with other ones, disteras.
Okay.
And what's the other little guy? Cyclosa.
All right. What about that,
sure.
PJ?
Well, when it comes to spiders, I mean, your report, Sylvia, that you haven't found many lately, it really seems to be in contrast from a lot of the reports that I get. I mean, even observations in my own home and in other places in the state, spiders in general still seem to be fairly common. I really haven't gotten any indication that their numbers are declining. Now, for some of the specific ones that you mentioned, Argyope and Aranius, which are some of our large orb weavers, they can be fairly common late in the summer, July, August, September, even into early October. Those are definitely still out there in the state, although from my own experience, can be a little bit hit or miss from year to year. You could have the really big garden spiders in your backyard 1 year, and you could go 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years before you see them again. So that's not all that unheard of to have that pattern. So overall, my impression is that the spiders are definitely still out there. I haven't really gotten any idea that they're declining in numbers.
There you go. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Pat in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Pat.
Hi. This is in response to the ambush bug caller. And I wanted to say that last year on the beach in Cornucopia, Wisconsin, on a goldenrod flower, I saw a bug, and I was taking pictures of it. And it wasn't until I looked at the pictures closely, it was an assassin bug, and it had caught a tiny green beetle-like insect, and it was I think it was going to eat it. And so I wanted to let that gentleman know that it's a good pest control for the gardener.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Definitely, yeah. And I actually bump into that quite a few times in late summer. There are a number of assassin bugs that hang out on flowers, especially things like goldenrods. And one of them I think of in particular, ambush bugs. They tend to be kind of pale, yellow or whitish, some black on their bodies. And they blend in. They just sit there and wait for something to land. It could be a pest beetle that lands on the flower. They'll take care of them. So definitely beneficial. In some cases, they blend in so well that you might not see the insect at first, the predator insect. You might see the prey that they're eating. If you ever look at a flower and there's a bee or a butterfly sitting there hanging off the flower at a weird angle, I suspect they're probably getting eaten by one of those assassin bugs.
Very interesting. Thanks, Pat, for calling. Mary Ann in Milwaukee, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to give you an upside of the ant problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what they could do? The high-end gourmet section of your top department stores have a chocolate-covered ants.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, there's a surprisingly large number of kind of these novelty snacks, chocolate-covered ants and grasshoppers. I've seen scorpions and lollipops and things like that. So you'd be amazed what you can find at various stores or you can order off the internet.
Yeah, and an entomologist, Gene DeFoliart, I don't know if you ever met Gene, he's rest his soul now, was kind of specialized a little bit in insects as a food source for us.
He did, yeah. So Gene DeFoliart was a faculty member in the UW-Madison Entomology Department many years ago, and he was really one of the first people to start looking at insects as a possible food source, either for humans or in some cases, folks these days are talking about insects not so much for human consumption, but as a sustainable food source for animals, perhaps.
Yeah.
So there's a real big movement at the moment for edible bugs.
Yeah, I remember writing this dates me. I remember writing a story about Gene's work, and the Johnny Carson show got a hold of it, and he talked about it once on the show. Well, Gene happened to be watching. He just about fell out of his chair. Oh, my goodness me. Well, let's go to Elizabeth in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was working on a building. I do masonry for work this last summer. And in the upper awning of the building, brick building, there was a ginormous nest of wasps behind the brick. We tried using foam to cover it up. At first, they weren't bothering us. Then they started attacking us.
Yeah.
And then the college that we were working for, they eventually had to call an exterminator, which put powder in the actual nest to try to kill the wasps, but it didn't really seem to work. I didn't know if your expert would have any insight on this.
All right.
Sure. So my general thought is that the powder would be the way to go. If you do have a wasp nest in a location where it's causing hazard, in your situation, in an area where you are working and you're going to get stung, I would go with a powder-type formulation myself. In many cases, if you puff that powder using a bulb duster or other means into the entrance of the nest, that should take them out with one treatment. On occasion, you just have a particular nest, and it may be due to the structure of the building where they're going in and out, where it might take a second or a third treatment, but that's usually the way to go. The powders tend to work much better than aerosol sprays in those cases.
So if you don't get them all the first time, you try again and maybe a third time.
Yeah, I'd say in cases like this, gosh, maybe 90% of the time, a single dose does
it. We'll do it.
Every once in a while, you got to follow up a second or third time, though.
Thanks, Elizabeth. And here we are out of time, PJ. And, of course, you'll come back and be with us again, I assume.
Certainly.
He'll be back in a couple of months. And, in fact, he's back on March 15th. And that's going to be fun. We'll talk about that pollinator protection plan perhaps a little bit more. PJ Leash is in charge of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have him along. He'll be back March 15th. Tomorrow at this time, our vehicle maintenance expert is going to drop by to talk about how to safely jumpstart your car battery and take your car questions. So tune in for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.